Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Marca Mesut Özil.
Giroud pulling it back. Arsenal in front once more. Aaron Ramsey scores for the Gunners.
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra. As always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, good morning to you.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm all right. Got coffee, just had a Kit Kat. I think I'm fine.
Great. Coffee, but no cough.
Thankfully. What about you?
Yes, all fine, thank you. It's my wife's birthday today, so happy birthday, Camille.
Happy birthday, Camille.
A lockdown birthday.
Got enough birthdays?
I know. Well, I think she has probably had enough birthdays. We'll see. She don't know how happy she is about it being her birthday. But yeah, so, and it's a bank holiday.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, it's difficult to differentiate these days, though, isn't it? I mean, it all just feels very similar at this point.
It is. Bank holidays mean nothing anymore. There are no such things as bank. Every day is a bank holiday, kind of. Apart from the, you know, the holiday bit, probably the bank bit, you know.
Well, actually, what's been, I suppose, a bit unusual for you and I is that there hasn't been... There's normally football on Easter weekend, right? Loads of it. So it's certainly not a bank holiday for us, usually. So, yeah, I guess it's been a bit more like a holiday than normal. A tiny bit, except a holiday where you can't leave your house.
That's not really much of a holiday.
Sure.
It's sort of, you know, house arrest. Kind of, you know, in a very light way.
It's like we're very posh criminals, isn't it? We're like very, very sort of well-to-do criminals who can't be put into a high security, into a proper prison because we'll get beaten up.
Yeah. Now, you stay at home. Do you promise? I promise. I will. I'll stay at home for the most part. People are out, though. It was a lovely weekend here. People were out and about. You know, it was Easter. The supermarkets were crazy. But I don't have any interesting or fun anecdotes about anything because nothing has happened.
Yeah, no, I mean, people were more out and about this weekend here too. I was, you know, flashing judgmental looks in every direction if I felt they were breaching regulation. You look like you're on your second walk, mate. You've got a little spring in your step.
Hang on a minute.
Be careful.
I'm calling the cops.
Yeah. I've got a direct line set up.
You know, I guarantee it won't be too far or too long before that kind of thing starts happening. Because you know the way there are Twitter snitches. So, you know, if you were to say, to put out a tweet saying, Phil Collins, God, I hate that guy's music, whatever. Somebody will, like, tag Phil Collins in on the tweet and say, look, what about this Phil Collins? Those people, they're terrible people, obviously, because I don't know why they feel compelled to do that. Like, if you were if you were minded to, like, tell Phil Collins personally on Twitter, you could just copy him in yourself. Or you're just making an observation. And those people, you know, I go back to this perhaps sounding draconian. They should be in jail. Every time they do that, they should be put in jail. But I'm sure that that in time, people will start snitching on the people who are, you know, apparently or reportedly or maybe breaking the regulations about going on their second walk or social isolation and things like that.
But fear not, we can snitch on the snitches. And thus the circle of snitching will be complete.
There'll be a snitch app, won't there? There'll be an app for snitching. Just put in your neighbours. Have your neighbours had people over at the weekend? Where are those people coming from?
I know. Well, the thing is, you know, I've got to be careful because I live in Islington, a lot of Arsenal fans around here. Sometimes I get spotted, sometimes I get recognised. So I can't risk breaking any regulations, even if I wanted to.
Have you got restrictions on how far you can go from home? Are there...
I don't think there are explicitly. I think we're only supposed to leave the house for an hour's worth of exercise. So for me, there's a big restriction on how far I could physically get in an hour.
Yeah,
like about 400 yards.
Yeah, because you got to get like half an hour there, half an hour back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not fast.
You could be slower on the way back too, you know, when you run out of energy and stuff.
Well, what happens if the hour runs out and you're not home? You just...
turn into a pumpkin.
Yeah, exactly. You turn into a pumpkin on the streets of Islington.
Yeah. Just wash with pumpkins.
Have you got a geographic restriction?
Yes, 2 kilometres, unless you're sort of caring for a family member or you're doing shopping or whatever that might be. But, you know, for your exercise, for your daily exercise, which you're allowed out to do, obviously, you're not supposed to go more than 2 kilometres. So, you know, places you might go with the dogs, like the Phoenix Park, is a little more than 2 kilometres from my house. Not much more, but still, you're outside the rules. And I don't know that the 2 kilometre restriction, you can breach that because you need to exercise dogs. I don't think that's the case because, you know, dogs don't get coronavirus. So.
That's good. I mean, I'd hate to have to snitch on you. Dogs don't get it, but tigers do, apparently. Did you see that last
week? I saw that a tiger got it, but I'm not sure how real that was. And how the fuck did a tiger get a test? I mean, who went in there with the Q-tip to, like, stick it up a tiger's nose and then take it to a... not sure I believe that.
We can't get a test in this country for love nor money, but the tigers, somehow they've got one.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think there's probably, you know, a tiger lobby out there right now trying to keep tigers in the news, you know, for Netflix documentaries and what have you.
There was a thing on the news here, and this is terrible misinformation spreading by me because it's sort of one of those things where I've seen the headline and not properly read the story. But it was a warning about cats carrying coronavirus, not because they actually have it or are carrying it in that sense, but that because it could live on their coats in some fashion.
Oh, I mean, I guess that's plausible with any animal, though, isn't it? If you pet the animal, let's say you've got a cat and you pet your cat and you've got coronavirus because you just put your hand to your mouth because someone else has given it to you, and then you pet your cat and then your cat goes next door over the fence and into next door's house. As our cats used to do, they used to get breakfast and then they go next door and get second breakfast from the neighbours.
Here you go. Yeah, veterinary scientists. This is BBC News, so it's sort of, you know, fairly reputable outlet. Veterinary scientists have recommended cat owners keep their pets indoors to help prevent the spread of the coronavirus among animals. But don't worry, it's quite unlikely you can catch it off a cat.
Right.
So I don't really know what the worry is there.
Well, look, you know, we're all just discovering things about ourselves and the world and the way it operates in this time. So who knows? By this time next week, you know, magpies could have coronavirus. They could be a vector. They could be a super spreader of the coronavirus.
I've long suspected they're involved.
Would you put it past them?
No way.
No chance.
No way. So what about some actual Arsenal news, kind of?
Come on, let's do it then. Let's do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I presume you're talking about Unai Emery.
Oh, God. Poor old Unai.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm no great lover of the publication in question or of people's personal lives being...
Exactly. The kiss and tell thing is not great at all, but...
No. But it was... kind of entertaining in its own way.
For people who don't know, Unai Emery's former girlfriend told one of the least reputable newspapers out there, you know, probably the least reputable newspaper out there, you know the one I'm talking about, that he declared her a white witch and he had she had brought him lots of bad luck, and that's why he got the sack from Arsenal.
Turns out it was all her fault all along.
I mean,
yeah. I mean, I don't know. Something happened. I mean, but no, do you know what it did make me think, actually? And this is something that, as much as I'm sort of not particularly interested in the personal lives of footballers or people in football, and I think they should be left to get on with it privately, when someone is under enormous strain and under enormous pressure on a professional level, sometimes I forget, certainly, that there might be other factors contributing to that too. You know, that they have a life outside of football that might be, I don't know, impeding them or adding to their levels of stress, you know?
Yeah, that's true. That is true. And I think it's... I do remember... you know, people react differently to pressures of normal life. I remember, do you remember when the Jonathan Woodgate, Lee Bowyer thing happened?
Yeah.
And they were accused of that racially aggravated assault. And I remember Woodgate, all of it got on top of him. He wasn't well able to cope, but Bowyer played some amazing football during that period because the, you know, the football pitch was the way that he could forget it, I guess, or become distracted from it. So, yeah, I mean, there are, you know, elements of normal life that we see footballers as people who, just because they get paid a lot of money, and that's obviously something we're going to talk about today, should be immune from, you know, feeling down or feeling blue or feeling under pressure because of things that are happening, you know, at home or at work or whatever it might be. You know, the idea that these kind of footballing robots, you know, is quite prevalent. And maybe it's the kind of industry football is as well. You know, the way you're not supposed to show any weakness. You're not supposed to be anything but, you know, a man. Be a man. Man up. Do your manly best. You know, what kind of, you know, that kind of attitude towards things. You know, there's a wide variety of people and personalities in football. You know, as we're, I guess, more aware now.
Yes, absolutely. But yeah, I did catch that story over the weekend, and yeah, I mean, it obviously raised an eyebrow. But the wages story is the one I was actually, referring to.
Right. So, do you want to just sort of give a quick recap of this, because you wrote a piece for The Athletic along with Amy and David Ornstein, outlining some of the proposals by the club for the players to take wage cuts. So maybe you could just sort of lay it out there, and then we can talk about the dynamics of it or the various aspects of it and the players' response.
Yeah, so as far as I understand it, the club have approached the players pretty much directly with this offer, proposal, should we say, and it's for a 12.5% reduction in players' compensation, so effectively wages and bonuses, which will be deducted every month for 12 months from April to next March. Now, there is a kind of performance-related element here, because if Arsenal qualify for the Champions League in next season, 2021, that reduction will be returned in full to the players.
Right. So but not the Champions League... this season.
Exactly. Not the one in which we're ninth.
Not going to qualify for the Champions League.
Yes. The next season, which clearly the club expects to take place in something like full fashion, or certainly something where European qualification is available, if they make the Champions League, they will not lose any money. If they fail to qualify for the Champions League, but they qualify for the Europa League, the 12.5% will be reduced to 7.5% of earnings. If Arsenal fail to qualify for Europe in any fashion in the next season, it will be a definitive pay cut of 12.5%, and the players will not get anything in return. So that is, in essence, the proposal. It is caveated with, you know, if the current season, 2019-20, doesn't finish, or the club doesn't receive the expected payments from broadcasters, this will all be moot, essentially, because Arsenal will need to revise the situation at that point. So that is the club's proposal. And the players' preference, it would seem, is for not a cut, but a deferral.
Right.
So they would rather not... forgo wages entirely at this point. They would rather, put them aside and receive them at a later date, have some sort of guarantee in place for that.
Okay, what do we know about what the negotiation or lines of communication between the club and the players is at this moment in time? Hector Bellerin is the player's representative, the PFA representative. Yep. Every club has one. And I think, you know, it's worth pointing out at this point, isn't it, that the PFA, I think, have suggested to players that they reject the idea of pay cuts right now.
Correct. They are in part acting on PFA advice.
Yes.
When you ask what is the line of communication, I mean, Hector Bellerin is that line of communication. So this message, we believe, was received by him and relayed to the players, who then respond to him, and he, in turn, will relay that back to the club.
Right.
So it's quite a big responsibility, really, for a guy who's not the club captain, but clearly, you know, he has been in this role for some time and has the respect of this club and of the squad. And, you know, when you look at the squad, you'd think, well, yeah, he's a good person to be in that position. Really.
Sure. Okay. So this story emerged over the weekend, or the details of this proposal over the weekend. What is your understanding of how that information came to light?
Well, a lot of people had this information, right? So, you know, stories appeared kind of simultaneously across a lot of different publications.
Almost as if there had been a kind of briefing?
Well, yes, but I would say that's possible. But I would say it's not necessarily in the club's interests for this information to be out there. I think that there are people on the playing staff who feel a little bit aggrieved, potentially, about how this is, how the club are going about this.
Okay, so you suspect that the source of the information might have come from the player's side, and by that I don't specifically mean a player, it could be an agent or a manager or a representative or something like that.
Representative is an interesting one, because clearly all these players do have representatives who would normally negotiate their financial terms.
Yeah.
But in this situation, that's obviously not the case.
Well,
right?
why is that not the case? Because, you know, these are individual contracts. This is not a collective situation where, you know, we're all doing the same job at the same company. We're more or less paid the same wage. You know, there's a vast range of wages here. So I would assume that although Hector Bellerin is the representative of the players, you know, in terms of these negotiations and dealing with the PFA and taking the advice from the PFA, on an individual basis, the players, their agents and managers, financial managers, you know, other representatives, whoever they might be, must certainly be involved in terms of the advice that they're giving to the players, what they're suggesting
Absolutely.
To them as to whether or not they should accept this or not. So, you know, this is not like a simple case of, right, Hector, you represent all of us. You go talk to the club. The club make a proposal. We make a counter proposal. There's a negotiation. And together we will find this collective agreement. You know, to me, it feels an awful lot more complicated than that.
Yes. I think it's probably a little bit naive, maybe on the club's part, to think that, I mean, I don't know how realistically they think that this proposal would just kind of go through and pass without any problems. But of course, every player, and consequently every player's agent, is going to have a point of view on this, right? And their job, in terms of the representatives, is to get the best deal for their clients. So it makes a certain degree of sense as to why the club would seek to circumnavigate that. But I think the chances of that happening are pretty, of that working, should we say,
of course,
pretty slim.
Of course. You know, and there are other, you know, 12.5% to, you know, Mesut Ozil is very different from 12.5% for Joe Willock, for example. You know,
of course,
there are individual issues, individual circumstances, as we've said on the podcast before. Players may already feel that because they're not getting performance-related bonuses or things that are built into their contract right now, you know, when things are normal, you know, appearance money, goal bonus, win bonus, assist bonus, clean sheet bonuses, you know, so-called loyalty bonuses, where a player gets paid a certain amount of money just because they, you know, play games for the club that they're contracted to play for, you know, these loyalty bonuses, all of those things that are built into their contracts, they're not getting those anymore because, well, games aren't being played, obviously. So, you know... Go on.
Sorry, just to jump cut across, I was just sort of about to say that I do fear is maybe not the right word, but I do suspect that where this may end up is in individual negotiations. You know, I mean, if you look at the way football tried to handle this problem, in the first instance, they tried to agree a sort of Premier League-wide amount for cuts or deferrals. Then it was kind of deferred to a by-club basis. If clubs are unable to find an agreement that works for the whole squad, then you will be in a position where you will be negotiating with individuals, and that will be very lengthy and difficult and may take quite a long time.
Of course.
Just in pure practicality.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I don't really know why or how it could be any different, because you are dealing with, you know, let's say the first team squad, 25 individual contracts, you know, players earning a range of salaries. You know, there are other considerations, you know, personal circumstances, all of those things to take into account on an individual basis that you can't, you can't look at these and say, right, well, we've got to do this across the board and it's simple as that. You know, in an ideal world, maybe you could do that. But, you know, being realistic about it, how could that be the case? You know, and I thought there was an interesting line in the piece that you were involved in. It says, Mikel Arteta's squad are set to reject the club's proposal to collectively take a pay cut for a year, but are open to deferring their wages if assurances can be given that 100% of the jobs at the club will be protected. So to me, that speaks to maybe a consideration for other people at the club you know, the other departments and jobs and salaries that need to be paid. And I think, you know, at the moment, right, it looks to me, or people will say, this is a bad look for the players.
It is a bad look, isn't it?
It is a bad look.
On first glance, yeah. It's definitely a bad look.
It is, because people say footballers earn a lot of money. Why aren't they doing something? Why aren't they doing more? Why aren't they, you know, this, that, and the other? And I get it. I mean, on a surface level, I absolutely understand that. But I think once you get into the complexities of it, you can understand why, you know, they might be looking to go at this in a slightly different way, or at least get some assurances from the ownership, who, let's face it, would be quite happy to cut money across the board, whether it's first team players or anywhere else, if they could. So I you know, I'm not saying that the players are somehow, you know, these old-fashioned union men standing firm to protect the interests of everybody at the club, but, you know, if they want an assurance that if they take a pay cut or take a wage deferral, it will mean that all the rest of the jobs at the club will be protected, that's not a bad stance to take.
Well, I think clearly if you're going to be asked to do that, you're going to want a certain degree of assurance, aren't you, about how that resource will be reallocated, you know, what this means for everybody else. I mean, it is tricky because, you know, they probably... I mean, I'm generalising here, but probably those players, a 12% pay cut is not something they're not going to survive. You know, in the broader context of life, a lot of people are taking pay cuts, right?
Sure.
And they're doing that, you know, for a sort of collective good. So I do think that, you know, it would be different if I felt the players simply weren't prepared to do it. I think they absolutely are. They just want it to be on the right terms.
Yeah. I mean, look, the wage bill at the moment at the club, where is it? I was looking at, where is it? Swiss Ramble. 1 second. Wage bill, 232 million is the wage bill. But that's the wage bill for the entire club, right?
Mm.
That's not just the first team staff, as far as I'm aware. When the wage bill is reported, it's the wages of everybody at the club, not just the playing staff.
Sure.
If you take,
well, they obviously they're the vast majority of that. You know,
yeah, well, I mean, a very significant portion of it.
Yeah.
So we're looking at, you know, let's say a 12% pay cut by, let's imagine that that 232 million is just the players' wages for a second. So you're asking the players, let's say, what's 12% of 232 million? 10% is 23 odd million, 25 million, 28 million, something like that. Right, so that's £28 million saved on wages if you get that 12.5% pay cut through. And that is on the assumption that all that $232 million is just the players' wages. I'm, you know, as I wrote in the blog today, I'm a little bit cynical about the idea that players are being put in the spotlight again and again and again without people looking higher up. And people have cited examples at other clubs where, you know, players have taken pay cuts, significant pay cuts, etc. Some of those clubs are not owned by billionaires. They're owned by fans. You know, the situation is not the same. And Arsenal have, you know, a billionaire owner worth an obscene amount of money. So I can understand players being a little bit reluctant to be the first ones to take a cut without assurances about, you know, other jobs at the football club and everything else, without there being some spotlight shone, you know, on high. You know,
yeah.
So I think they, from what I'm understanding of this and from what they're saying, and I think it's really fair to point out that we have not heard from the players yet. We've heard this Arsenal proposal. We haven't heard specifically from the players about why it is, you know, they're not accepting this beyond PFA advice and other things. But it strikes me that there's a wariness about the implications of it, not just for them, but for other people at the club. And that's based on the way that the ownership have behaved.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that the players aren't naive. They're probably aware that the wage bill is a subject the club have been looking to address, right?
And
now, in fairness to the club, what I would say is there is a performance-related element to this. And if Arsenal qualify for the Champions League in 2020-21, you know, none of those players would take wage cuts, presumably because the club knows that their revenue would increase significantly with that. I suppose from the players' point of view, they would say, well, actually, a lot of those players are on contracts which automatically go up or down depending on whether the club make Champions League or not anyway.
Yeah.
Ready.
Also, you know, are you, as the owners of the football club, going to invest in the squad, in the team, to make it sufficiently competitive to make Champions League qualification realistic? You know, there's that side of it as well.
Yeah, very true. Very true. I mean, if you're, let's say you're Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, right? Let's take that example. And you're on what you're on, and you are told you're going to lose a substantial amount of money as a cut. And maybe you're thinking, well, you know, are the club going to support the push for Champions League qualification with the requisite purchases and investment?
Are they going to get us a defence?
Yeah, for example.
Something like that, you know, some small minor part of, you know, being a good football team. Are they going to, you know, provide us with the players that we need and require to make that step up and that improvement? So, you know, that's another factor. It's all well and good saying, well, look, here's a performance-related bonus, or here's a motivating factor for you. You won't lose a penny if you qualify for the Champions League. But, you know, it's like telling me, here's 100 grand if you can run the 200 metres in 20 seconds. You know, not going to happen.
Yeah, you won't lose any money if you make us a load of money. It's basically the pitch. But, I mean, it is tricky because I do think there are really two sides to this. You know, the players must be aware that not accepting this at the drop of a hat you know, is a bad look. Do you know what I mean? They must know, well, this isn't great PR. And I think, consequently, they must be given this pretty serious thought and have quite clear reasons for doing it. You know,
yeah.
I don't think footballers are so detached from reality that they just think, oh, yeah, this will look fine.
Yeah, fuck
care.
It. Like, who gives a shit? You know, I completely agree with you there. Yeah.
A lot of people will have read that headline yesterday and sort of thought that's terrible on the part of the players.
Yeah.
You know? I do think.
You know, I agree. And I've seen some reaction to it online. And look, I get it as well, because on the face of it, when you look at it, it's like, oh, come on, guys, it's only 12%. But, you know, the complicated manner of the negotiations, you know, and everything else involved in this means that, I think you're right. I think they do know. They've got to be aware of how it's going to look. I think it would be, you know, they must know there's going to be some backlash. Again, I think we need to get as much information as we can on this before we make a definitive judgment on how they've behaved. But I think it's also reasonable, regardless of how well you're paid, to protect your own interests when you're an employee of a club owned by a billionaire. And if sort of on the side of that, you're looking after the interests of some of the other people who work at the club, because I think the article, you know, says that the players are open to deferring their wages, but also donating a week's wages to pay the salaries of non-playing staff.
Like, yeah, that was a separate proposal that's been made by the club, to donate a week's wages to pay.
That's lovely, isn't it?
Non-football staff, and as far as we know, the players are relatively on board with that.
Okay, you
know,
so
yeah.
But then, you know, why are players being asked to donate a week's wages when Stan Kroenke could pay those wages without even a blink of an eye? You know, I get it. It's good. It's nice for the players to do that. But again, it's putting things on them. I think that I don't know. It just seems like they're an easy target, and I think this is a complicated situation. And I think if they're taking the time to do it properly and to think about it properly and to think about the implications of it, not just for them, then I think that's all right. But I would be interested to hear what they have to say and if there's going to be some kind of a communication from them, because the immediate reaction is, well, the players are just greedy bastards and that's the end of it. And I don't believe that's the case, particularly with the group of players that we have who have, in fairness, demonstrated, you know, an awareness and a sort of conscience about what's going on at this moment in time in terms of what they're saying, what they're doing and everything else. It would just be remarkable to me that they're just like point blank, no, fuck it, fuck off, we're not taking a pay cut. There's got to be more to it.
Yes, and I think, you know, if you look at the broader context here, deferrals have been agreed at Premier League clubs who are in, rather than cuts, I mean, deferrals, who are in less financially strong positions than Arsenal, theoretically. You know, clubs who are outside the top six, outside of European football. And so, you know, it's entirely plausible that Arsenal players would be looking at that and saying, well, you know, how come that's the situation for those guys and not for us? I mean, I think the real issue here is that, you know, as Josh Kroenke alluded to, or not alluded to, said directly, Arsenal are, you know, a Europa League club with a Champions League wage bill. But, I mean, whose fault is that? You know, like who's made those decisions? Who has sanctioned those contracts? You know, the mismanagement financially of the wage bill is actually not the player's fault.
True, and actually, when I had a discussion with Kieran from Swiss Ramble a few weeks back on the Arsecast, I sort of threw that quote out to him, and he sort of not poo-pooed it, but said it's actually not quite accurate, because the clubs that are in the Champions League actually have a Champions League wage bill. What we have are a few players earning way, way too much based on what they're contributing. But in general, you know, we're not there in terms of the wages that the other clubs are paying to their players. So, you know, it's a nice soundbite, but it's not necessarily 100% accurate.
No, absolutely. And it's a really, really interesting one. I hope. What do you think on the issue of cuts versus deferrals? Do you have sort of an instinctive feel about which of those is right?
I think probably a pay cut is the right way to go because, you know, let's be realistic about what's going on with the business. What's going on with the business of football and businesses all over. I think that, you know, revenue streams have completely dried up. We saw Liverpool last week, didn't we? I think we were talking about it on the podcast last week before they rolled back, where, you know, they were going to furlough their staff. And then there was such an outcry to it. They went back on it and they said, look, we made a mistake. But what I thought was quite interesting about the letter that the chairman, what's his name, Peter Moore, put out was that he said, okay, we made a mistake here, but, you know, please be aware. Basically, we're saying, look, the finances are fucked. Our revenue streams are fucked. We've got no money coming in whatsoever from all the usual sources, and we've got all these expenditures and wages to pay and bills to pay and all those kind of things. You know, if Liverpool are telling you that, okay, we're going to go back on this, but basically our financial situation is not really that strong, you know, that's got to be true of Arsenal. It's got to be true of lots of clubs. So I think, you know, instinctively, I would say that pay cuts are a way for businesses in general to survive trying times, right? So I think it's... I think it's probably the right way to go. It's about how it's implemented, though, and what the implications are across the board. Because if they can cut the wages of playing staff, I think we have this idea in our head that, okay, well, the players have taken a pay cut, therefore the wages of everybody else at the club are going to be protected. And I don't know that that's necessarily true. I certainly wouldn't have a great deal of faith that that was going to be true. So somehow, somehow this reduction that the players take, it funds everybody else. And players, as you say, can afford to take a pay cut. They, you know, they have a lifestyle, et cetera, to support. But at the end of the day, there are people working for Arsenal who are counting on their wages to pay their bills, to pay their mortgage, to pay their childcare, to pay all of those things that regular day-to-day people have to pay in their jobs. So I would worry that, you know, if they say, well, look, we've got the players to take a pay cut, we'll just cut everyone else as well. Like, I don't trust the ownership of the club to behave or to not do to everyone else what they want to do to the players. And I think that's where this issue becomes quite complicated for me, because it's not going to be just players.
Yeah, I'd like to think that if I was a player, I would be open to the idea of a cut, but I would want some assurances about what would happen to that money, how it would be used to protect the jobs of other people who are paid less. And I think I would also probably want some demonstration from the club's billionaire owner that they were prepared to put their hand in their pocket as well. You know, I think that would be a reasonable thing to want as a player. And I suspect that if those elements, you know, are met, then maybe we will see an agreement. I mean, I suppose the one good thing is, if it is Hector Bellerin leading these negotiations, we know he's very eloquent. We know he's a very good communicator. So perhaps it's not beyond the realms of fantasy to suggest we might hear something from the players' side, because I think, if you know, he's very good at that side of things, at the media side. So potentially we will hear something. It would be fascinating to know kind of where they stand, you know, officially.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I think before people go too crazy about, you know, greedy footballers and all that, let's wait and hear what they have to say, because it feels now that this thing is out in public, they kind of have to say something, or they have to address it in a meaningful way. Otherwise, you know, the sort of... the surface damage that this has done won't be repaired, you know? So I think we will. And I think, yeah, I don't know. I mean, there are obviously, this is an issue that's going to be going on at other football clubs as well. It won't be just Arsenal. So,
no.
Yeah, it's a little bit unfortunate that you know, our situation is being played out in public the way that it is. It feels like it probably would have been more beneficial for all this to happen behind closed doors, and then some kind of an announcement on An agreement would have been good, but you know, we do things the Arsenal way. I mean, we've been the leaders.
This is very Arsenal.
It is, and we've been the leaders in coronavirus related developments more than any other football club. They're wondering about, you know, should we shut football down for a bit? Bang, our manager gets coronavirus.
Yeah,
and that's it. You know, so you know we've led the way here. So maybe we're doing that again.
By the way, a little sort of subject change there. There's a nice pivot on Mikel. He's been around and about doing a bit of press here and there. He was on Sky Sports News the other day.
Mm.
What an absolutely insane first year as a manager he is having. It is completely bonkers. The whole thing. Can you imagine? I mean, never in a million years could he have dreamt, or in his worst nightmare, what his kind of baptism in management might be like.
I know. I mean,
it's incredible.
I don't think any manager has ever had so much to deal with in such a short space of time. And when you consider, you know, where Arsenal were when he took over, you know, even when you go back, do you remember the Man City game?
Mm.
It was sort of being rumoured, wasn't it, that, you know, he might move to us after the Man City game, that had to get that fixture out of the way. The sort of surreal nature of him sitting on the Man City bench, looking at Arsenal being completely and utterly outclassed by Manchester City, a team devoid of spirit, commitment, energy, all of the things that, you know, he brought to the club as a player and things that he associated as a player, a style of football that was just, you know, it was horrendous. It was horrible. You know, Arsenal had fallen so far in real, real trouble heading towards the relegation zone. Remember, we were talking about Arsenal being in a relegation dogfight at that point.
Yeah.
So he comes in, he takes over, and all of this stuff is happening. It is completely and utterly bizarre, surreal. And if you were to sit down and write it in a script, it would be rejected because people would say this is too far-fetched. Mm. You say, it is mad. Mad.
It is mad. And also, I saw him speaking on Sky Sports News, and I thought the way he spoke about how he's trying to communicate with his players and, you know, the benefits of spending time with the family, like, he is conducting himself in a really classy manner. Mm. Throughout the whole thing, and you know, I sort of hope and suspect he will be a better manager for all this. But I do think that, yeah, I just can't believe what he's having to go through. And when football starts again, he'll be like, oh my god, how am I supposed to pick this up? You know, it was hard enough when I walked into the club. Now this is just,
yeah. I mean, that's a good point, isn't it? Because when you think about it, and when you look at the way that Arsenal had performed since he took over, obviously he stabilized things. We were struggling maybe to find the right balance, weren't we, from an attacking point of view and everything else.
Mm.
But, you know, since he took over, what did we lose twice? Two games. We lost two games. We'd been finding it difficult to grind out the wins, but, you know, in the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, I think we won, is that 2, 3, 6, 6 of our last 8. And of course, the Olympiacos game was a clusterfuck. Not that it matters anymore, because European football is over for the foreseeable future. But, you know, we were beginning to sort of take little steps forward. And it's not quite going back to square one. But, you know, it is going to be a case that we're going to have to pick it up again. And, you know, let's say, imagine something crazy, like in a month's time, they say football is going to begin again in a month.
Mm.
Or football is ready to begin again. You still need to, it's almost like they're going to need a preseason to get going.
Absolutely.
Again, because you can't just go, okay, tomorrow we start. It's not going to be that simple, you know?
Yeah. Depending on who you speak to, some clubs say, I have heard 2 weeks, most are saying 3 or 4 before they would be ready to play. And bear in mind, you might also be picking up a squad who might be slightly at loggerheads with the club, given all this that's playing out in the media. Players who don't know where their future lies, you know, what's happening with the transfer window, what's happening with contract situations.
Mm.
Yeah, it's... it's an absolute mess for anybody, but for someone who is, you know, so inexperienced and in their first job, it's yeah, I just have a huge amount of sympathy with Mikel for what he is having to deal with in this first year in the job.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, we'll leave it there for part one. We've got questions which we'll address, and some of those are related to this discussion. We will do that in part two right after this.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog, also on the Arsblog Facebook page, facebook.com/TheArsblog, and on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. Just sort of following on from our discussion in part one, James, Gav, who's at 88Gav, says, with reports of players being unhappy with pay cut proposals, or perhaps the way that those proposals were presented to them, do you think it will affect contract negotiations with players such as Bukayo Saka and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang?
Well, I don't see how the club can enter sort of negotiations about a new contract in the current climate. Do you?
No. I mean, it's very difficult to... Yeah, I mean, how could you? Because you don't know when football is going to begin again. You don't know when you're going to get money in again. You don't know when you're going to start raising revenue and all that kind of stuff. So right now, I don't know how that's possible. But could it possibly affect a player's decision-making? You know, if they feel, for example, that the way the club have asked them to take pay cuts or whatever it might be, if they feel aggrieved at that, and that is a sense that we're getting, isn't it? There's a sort of, you know, collectively they feel a little bit aggrieved about the way this thing has been done.
Yeah.
Then it may well have an impact on a player's desire to stay or willingness to sign a new contract or anything like that.
Yeah, and I think it's I think you're right to say the way it's been done. I don't think it is the principle, you know, of sacrificing some amount of earnings to save other people's jobs. I know we've sort of reiterated that a couple of times, but I think it is the manner in which it's been undertaken that seems to have slightly irked the playing staff. And I think, of course, it could have an impact. And I mean, I do find it very difficult to see how the club can sort of genuinely make a proposal to a player about a new contract until this is resolved. And we touched on sort of Liverpool and the furloughing of staff in part one. You know, I suspect Arsenal's decisions about what they're going to do, you know, with certain staff will depend on the outcome of these negotiations with the players. So, you know, there is so much that kind of rides on this, you know, and that rides on the TV revenue. I mean, the communication from the club to the players made it pretty clear that if Arsenal don't get the TV revenue that they are due for this season, the situation will be very grave. And I mean, I think that's a direct quote, very grave. You can't really see it plainer than that. I do think that there is a possible knock-on effect if players are affronted by the way in which this has been handled. But more so than that, I fear that they can't begin negotiations in earnest until there's greater clarity about the financial future of the club.
Do you think maybe the players, you know, when they're being asked to do this by okay, look, executives are not necessarily as well paid as players, unless you're, you know, at Tottenham. And the Daniel Levy gets paid more than most of the players. Sure. But, you know, if they are to be asked to sacrifice something slash set an example slash, you know, do their bit for everyone, shouldn't everyone at that kind of level who's earning that kind of money also take a pay cut?
I think so. You know, if you can ask, you know, Bukayo Saka on his $3,000 a week or whatever it is to lose 12.5%, then I think if you're a very well-paid executive, it's not unreasonable to think that you should sacrifice that 12.5% too.
Mm.
I also think, you know, something we were just chatting during the break and something that came up was the sense that it's important to remember that players, many players are already helping in this crisis. I mean, I believe the Arsenal players pretty much collectively have joined the Football United fundraising campaign. As well as that, there is the Arsenal Foundation, which, you know, is in part funded by the players and other staff at Arsenal. And as well as that, they have many individual charity endeavours that they do or don't publicise to different extents. You know, I think footballers, not all footballers give something back, but plenty do. Mm-hmm. And I think that just because we don't always hear about it doesn't mean it's not necessarily happening.
Yeah, that's a fair point to make.
But yeah, it. I mean, what this means for specifics of football, like contracts, transfers, it is almost impossible to say at this point, I think. I mean, somebody asked a question to that extent. It was Andy Gillette, actually, who said, "Hi, guys, hoping you and yours are all safe and well." Thanks, Andy. "Do you think player swaps instead of buying players when football resumes would be the best way forward until such time as the football economy recovers?"
Again, you know, I don't know. I just don't know what the transfer market is going to be. We had a question about, like, here was from at LT Arsenal, and it was like, would you be open to selling Lucas Torreira for 30 or 35 million?
Yes.
And he asked that in the context of if it meant signing a more complete base midfielder, I guess deep-lying midfielder, in terms of being physically imposing, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, now, if someone was to say, well, would you sell Lucas Torreira for 30, 35 million? That sounds like an extraordinarily high amount of money for a footballer, doesn't it? Even if, you know, it's not massive
well,
in terms
of
profit.
You wouldn't have to cut all those wages.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that what you'd make?
That's exactly. You just sell one player at a time. And, you know, but, you know, I just don't know what way. I mean, how do you, you still have to put a value on a player. It's okay saying, well, let's have player swaps and what have you. But, like, how do you decide, you know, I'll swap you one Lionel Messi for 26 Shkodran Mustafis. You know, I don't know how you still have to put a value on a player. And then it depends on whether or not that player is deemed as valuable by the club that you want to swap with. I mean, it seems like a much more complicated way to do things. I just think we're probably going to see a vast reduction in transfer fees as and when things get going again. I mean, I even saw some conscientious comments from Kia Jurabchian. Did you see those over the weekend?
I know, yeah. Taken aback.
You know? Let me see if I can...
To be fair, he's probably done all right out of football so far, so he can take a back seat.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. I mean, what did he say? I can't remember.
They were relatively reasonable.
It was basically
comments,
along the lines of, like, you know, how can we, if the ordinary man is struggling, blah, 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 you know, can the football club be seen to, you know, spend tens of millions of pounds on a footballer? I mean, I'm paraphrasing wildly here, but that was the gist of it.
To that effect, yeah. Absolutely. And I agree wholeheartedly. I do think transfer fees may become a thing of the past. I mean, you know, when most clubs look at a player, they assess their collective value. So it's the transfer fee amortised over however long the contract is plus the salary.
Mm.
And I think I think the weight of the player's salary in all transfer decisions will be much greater. Almost, I think that I almost think that there might be a thing where players with particularly big salaries, you know, slightly burdensome salaries, there will be real attempts made to offload them, and I think it will become problematic. But
I mean, look, you know, we let's use Mesut Ozil as an example here. Going into the final year of his contract on his 350 grand a week, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it was always a tiny handful of clubs who could afford to take on that kind of a contract. I don't know that there are, you know, one or two now who could do that apart from, you know, the PSG, the Man City type clubs who can do it, you know?
I just wonder if, given that the club are as keen as they are to save 12% of player salaries across the board, might you see more situations where they agree to pay a certain extent of a player's wages, do you know what I mean, in order to save more?
Yeah.
I don't know, but I think they'll be looking to make savings any way they can.
You know, if you, I say this in inverted commas, if you got rid of Ozil's salary and Aubameyang's salary, there's your 12.5% at least, you know, in that. You know, Mkhitaryan's salary that we're still paying a fair chunk of, 200 grand a week. You know, there are clearly ways in which you can reduce your wage bill, but it's just not going to be the same as it was before. Just impossible, I think.
Yeah, it's going to change dramatically. And, you know, it will be difficult, but I guess maybe football will operate, as we've said before, sort of a little bit more in the real world as a consequence.
Is it my question or your question?
I'm not sure, actually. I think it's yours, technically.
Okay. From Facebook, Aman Singh Kella says, given the latest article from The Athletic saying we ignored our scouts in the purchases of Lucas Perez and Shkodran Mustafi and potentially others, is it now time to stop blaming Wenger and put it squarely at the door of Ivan Gazidis and Stat DNA for our current weaknesses?
Do you know what, actually? I'm quite glad to have the opportunity to clear that up to an extent, because this is a reference to a piece I wrote about Francis Kagagao, who, you know, is now the head of international scouting at the club, has been on the scouting team for some time. And it mentioned those two transfers, Lucas Perez and Mustafi, as ones that the scouting team were not convinced by and not proponents of, but the stats team did make a bit more of a case for, you know, that they did push slightly more for. But what's important to say is that that decision was still Arsene's. He saw scouting and stats as two valuable tools in the assessment of a player. And in those instances, he chose to, you know, go with the statistical advice. And there are other criteria. So, for example, in Lucas Perez, Arsenal needed a striker and it was the end of the window and he had a release clause and it was a deal you could get done in 2 days and they pulled the trigger on it. And to a certain extent, it was the same with Mustafi. There was a price they knew that if they paid such and such a price, they'd get the player. And statistically, there was a sort of fairly good grounding for it. But ultimately, the responsibility, I think, in that situation has to lie with the decision maker. And the decision maker, for his entire time at the club, was Arsene. And, you know, you can query the stats that proposed those players, but I think the responsibility still has to lie ultimately with the guy who pushes the button, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, he had the say on who he brought in and who he didn't.
And, you know, I think that's an interesting thing about scouting, and I guess stats to an extent, is that they make recommendations, but it's not their decision. And that means sometimes, you know, it'll work out well and other times not. And that's kind of the job. I think what is most interesting really is that there has been this kind of discordance between the two departments. And you know, Arsenal, if you look at Arsenal's transfer policy over the last however many years, 10 years almost, it's never felt particularly joined up. And maybe that has played its part, a little bit of tension or you know, it's not necessarily a shared vision across the whole of the recruitment department.
Yeah, I mean, I think the recruitment department is probably a bit more defined now, or certainly on paper, than it was. I mean, you think back, and I think you referenced this in the article that you wrote, you know, the summer where we were basically about to sign Juan Mata.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding of that there was a sort of a prevarication. I'm not quite sure at which end, whether it was to do with his valuation or whatever, but a sort of, things weren't all joined up there behind the scenes from an Arsenal point of view. He ended up at Chelsea, even though I think there were stories that he was pretty much on the verge of signing for Arsenal. I think he was one of those whose father was his agent.
He is indeed.
Yeah. And
represents it.
Yeah. I remember doing stories about it or writing about it at that point. So, you know, there were things about the way that we did our business that, you know, we're all well aware of, which had a big impact on the deals that we did.
Yeah. And, you know, the scouting, I mean, I talk about this in the piece, but the scouting department's recommendation that summer when we lost Cesc Nazri was to get Juan Mata and Santi Cazorla. And Arsenal, for different reasons, didn't land either of those players then. Mata went to Chelsea, Cazorla went to Malaga. Fortunately, Malaga effectively went bust, so we were able to get him a year or so later. But it's you know, I mean, with all these players, you know, your Martinellis or your Fabregases, that, you know, I mean, Cagayao's record is excellent, but there are always hits and misses, you know, for any scout.
For
that's
sure.
Sort of the game. It's like it's the transfer industry as a whole, isn't it? It's, you know, there's always a margin of error, but you're just hoping to kind of narrow that as much as possible.
Mm.
But yeah, interesting times in terms of the recruitment department because, you know, we've seen Jason Rosenfeld move on. And as we wrote in The Athletic at the time, there was a slight sense that maybe from a stats perspective, they felt that they were not marginalised necessarily, but maybe less involved than they had been on that front.
Mm.
And you wonder, given the way we are doing a lot of our business now with a kind of contact-driven, agent-led approach, whether the same could be true on the scouting side. You know, maybe there's a degree to which they're not being consulted quite as much as they were certainly under Arsene, who had enormous faith and value and respect for, you know, the experienced eye when it came to spotting talent.
Yeah. Speaking of Martinelli, have you seen the clips of him doing his weights in the back garden and stuff?
Yeah.
Wow. Beefcake.
I know. I mean, he's got a little goal in his garden. Have you seen? He's with like one of those sheets across it with whole target practice in the top corners and stuff. And he's keeping himself keeping himself busy.
He's ripped now. You know, he's working on his physicality.
Well, that's an aspect of his game that's going to develop, right? I mean, he's so young still.
That's true.
Between
he is
18 and 21. I think you would anticipate his body changing a lot. And he, you know, I mean, who knows? He might go through that kind of Ronaldoization, you know? It's not improbable.
Hopefully without as many bulging veins.
Yeah, I mean, no one needs a neck quite that big.
No.
But he is an admirer of Ronaldo, I
believe. So. That's true.
Yeah, we shall see. Right, let's have... I mean, we've sort of dealt with this. Dave on Twitter said, you'll probably address it on the podcast, but why is the focus on players when most clubs have billionaire owners? I think we've kind of said our piece on that.
Kind of have, all right, yeah.
Yeah. Pablo Eagle on Twitter said, do you think there's a danger that some fans will get used to this new normal without football? So when it eventually returns, the passionate bond between supporter and sport will have broken. I suppose I'm asking if you think it will ever go back to quite how it was.
I guess, you know, it will have an impact on some fans because they're probably going to be dealing with other things that are more important, you know. It's easy to grant football huge importance in your life when when everything's kind of going all right. And I don't mean to say that's the only reason why football is important. For some people, it can be, you know, an escape from, you know, a life which isn't as great as they want it to be. But football provides that sort of escapism, or that, you know, gives you that focus, which helps you get through. But I think, you know, if you, the far side of this, are dealing with very serious things, whether that is loss of a job, loss of a business, loss of friends or family members, you know, I do think it will have an impact on some people and their willingness to devote the time and energy and money that it requires to follow football in the way we did before. I think it's only normal when we try and project forward and think about what the world is going to be like when all of this is over, and the consequences and the ripple effects that this will have, unquestionably. You know, I don't think we even understand 10% of what's coming down the line in terms of how people are going to be affected and the way that the world works. It strikes me that it can't possibly just go back to being what it was, because that means we haven't learned anything. It means that the various ways in which all the aspects of our life are impacted just haven't happened. And I think we're beginning to see that those things are having an effect right now. So, yeah, I think it is going to have an impact. Maybe some of it will be positive. Maybe some of it will be things that we can say, okay, we need to make that better. We need to improve that. We need to be more conscientious. We need to understand that football is a wonderful thing, but is it something we should use to squeeze every last penny out of every person who's, you know, loves football or loves the game, or, you know, the sort of overkill we've had with football? Like the fact that there is essentially now no time in the year where there isn't football. You know, the season ends, there's internationals, there's preseason tournaments, the season begins again, there's internet, you know, it never ends. Maybe we need to think about that a little bit. But I can't imagine that the game won't change and people's perception of the game won't change because of everything that we're going through right now.
Yeah. And in terms of sort of, do I think that this will create a bit of a disconnect in the bond between, you know, the club and the supporters? I don't think it will, from sort of what I would term as like the hardcore support, you know, people who are real Arsenal fans. That's not going to go anywhere. But I think with the Premier League in particular, there is a kind of fringe support. The idea of like a casual fan does exist, you know. And I think that maybe it's very possible that that connection might be broken by the lack of contact, the lack of you know, sport fundamentally. But I think that what that means is that, you know, Arsenal do have, and very fortunate to have, a huge faithful support. And what I hope is that when they come out of this crisis and realise that is still there for the most part, that they look after it. You know, and take steps to protect it and make sure that the game and the club remain accessible to them in the new economic landscape.
Is it my question? It is my question. Sort of along the similar lines, Wise Marklar on the Discord says, I'm starting to really miss football now. Are you? On top of that, are there things you miss that you never thought you'd miss? Like Steve McManaman's voice, for example.
Am I missing football? I am missing the games, and I have to say, I don't really find the retro stuff particularly sort of satiates that for me. You know, like, I don't find myself watching vintage Match of the Days or, you know, it's...
Euro 96 on YouTube.
Yeah.
Sit down,
Like, look, I have fond memories of those occasions, and I see the value in it, but... there's something about the excitement of live football that you cannot beat. And I mean that in every respect. You know, my other life, I've performed comedy, and live comedy, there's a thrill about it. You know, and people keep saying, are you going to do an online gig? And I'm like, well, I think it would be horrible. Like,
Feedback. I can imagine. Yeah, no, you don't know what's working. Yeah, I mean, that is the beauty of football, isn't it? It's the live experience. We can all go back and relive things, but it's not the same. It's not anything close to the same.
And the drama of that and the spectacle of it. And I think even when we get football back, I think it's inevitable it will be behind closed doors. And I think even that, I think it will be exciting because it's new and it's happening now. But I think it will still not feel like I want it to quite. So, yes, I do miss football. I miss football matches, you know, because that's really what it's about. There's still plenty of chat about football, but it's just not as engaging and not as fun. Do you miss football?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I miss the kind of structure it gives my life in a way. You know, when is the next match? And there's so much of my entire life has revolved around football matches and football that, I miss it. And I miss the experience of games and live games and the emotions. And, you know, I was beginning to enjoy it again after a period, you know, under Unai Emery, where I really didn't. I found Arsenal a chore. Watching that team, I found it very difficult to enjoy what we did and how we did it. I don't think I'm alone in that because of the, you know, the results and the football that we played and everything else. I felt in some ways a little bit disconnected from the club and from the team, which isn't to say I wasn't invested, because of course I am. I'm a fan and a supporter, and I want the team to do well at all times. But, you know, at the same time, you can acknowledge that when your team is poor, you cannot enjoy it. And I was beginning to enjoy it again under Arteta. I was beginning to sort of feel a little bit optimistic about where we were going and how we were going to get there. I enjoyed listening to Arteta speak and to sort of outline the visions that he has for the club and the players and the team and what he wants it to be. And it resonated with me because I shared that. I shared sort of his idea of how football should be played and what kind of football Arsenal should play. So having just got that back a bit and then for it to be taken away, and, you know, I'm not criticizing that because we know it's the right decision to make. But yes, I'm missing it. I'm missing the games and the goals and the moments and the ups and the downs and the highs and the lows, rather than a sort of continuous low. Not low, but I don't know how to describe it. Like, Unai Emery was sort of like footballing tinnitus. It's just this low-level irritation all the time. And it went away. It was replaced by silence and maybe the beginnings of birdsong. And now it's gone, so.
It's a very poetic idea. Is there anything you miss that you're surprised that you miss? In football terms, I guess.
I don't think so, because it's all just part of one big package, isn't it? You know, all the.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose on that.
I miss Lampard out. Hashtag.
Well, that's it. I was going to say if you only brought back Arsenal games, that wouldn't be enough, really, to really satisfy you.
Schadenfreude, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The other matches really matter too. The context and the full picture, so that you can enjoy laughing at your rivals as much as celebrating your own team's achievements. I think that's a big thing. I miss Spurs stuffing stuff up. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I know what you mean. And sort of slightly related to this, Gunranjan on the Discord says, what is the most pointless football-related argument you've had with someone, only to realise later that it was such a waste of time? I had an argument with a Man United fan about whether Danielson is better than Anderson. The way the careers of both those players turned out, it seems so futile.
God, that's great. I mean, yes.
Like, I can't think of one, but I just really like that that concept. You know, this is part of what we miss. Is like, well, how could you say this about this player? Because blah blah. Let me break out the stats and I'll argue with you about this, that, and the other.
And there's someone on Arsenal Twitter, and I forget which account it is, that basically thrives on just doing these. Like, they seem to find Man U fans saying, "Oh, Rashford's better than Martinelli or something," and then they just take issue with it. It's become like a kind of subculture of Twitter.
I think I know who you're talking about here. Is it Dan Critchlow?
Yeah, I think
who writes for the Daily Canon.
Yeah. They've made it an art form almost.
At AFCDW, and some Man United fan will say, well, Martinelli could never, whatever it might be, whatever the thing the kids say these days.
And whatever Mason Greenwood has done.
Yeah, exactly. And then he comes out with a ream of stats and goes, well, actually, it's quite funny.
Yeah.
But time-consuming, I would say.
It is time-consuming. It's enjoyably petty, I would say.
Gunranjan, in about 12 years' time, ask that question of Dan, and he'll be able to give you about 500 examples.
Exactly. Let's have a look at this. Okay, Ivan Ho on the Facebook says, recently, Lord Bentner, our Lord and Saviour, Nicholas Bentner, has stated his wish to be a football coach when he retires.
Mm.
Who do you think among the current players will be a good coach in the future?
Okay, let me have a think about that.
It's interesting, who amongst us? Because when Arteta was playing, you kind of had the sense, oh yeah, he'll be involved in the game.
Yeah,
and Mertesacker to an extent too, albeit in a different aspect of football, he is involved now.
Let's think. Who would be a good coach? Is that what the question was?
Yeah, I'm going to say that I think Granit Xhaka might go into coaching.
I was going to say he has that kind of personality, that sort of strong belief in himself that you need to be a coach or a manager.
Big ego, decent communicator, swears a lot.
Yeah.
He's one.
I'm looking through the squad and I'm thinking, like, do I see Aubameyang? I mean, he's often the guy that's front and center for interviews and all that kind of stuff, you know, after games, and he talks pretty well. But I do sort of have this vision of him when he's finished playing, you know, having a good time.
Yeah.
But then again, it could be, I'm looking at the squad and I'm thinking, I don't know.
I mean, Lacazette, maybe? I don't know. He's
no.
Someone who's, you
no,
don't think so?
Don't think so.
Do you think there's a sort of like, and do you think there's a sort of a bias towards the defence? Often people think of centre halves as good coaches. Like, what about Socrates, David Luiz?
David Luiz. I could see David Luiz becoming the manager of Brazil.
I can kind of see Luiz doing it. I have that slight sense to do with Aubameyang of like, he might just want to chill after his playing career.
Just get a hammock.
Yeah, I think David Luiz would be a good number two. I think he'd be like a great coach to sort of be the connection between the coaching staff and the playing squad. I think I see him more as that maybe than the main man. He'll be assistant to Xhaka in the Arsenal management team in 15 years' time.
Mm. So. Yeah, that's about it though. I mean,
It's less and less the case, I think, isn't it, in the modern game? I'm thinking of people who've left Arsenal, like someone like Jack Wilshere. I think he'll definitely go into coaching. And he's spoken about it already, I believe.
Yeah.
Maybe he's already got one eye on when he might have to retire. Who knows? But
maybe.
I don't know. It's hard to predict as well. You get surprises. You know, I don't think anyone would necessarily have said Freddie Ljungberg.
Yeah, but you know, when you go back as well, and you look in the past, and people will say, "Well, who's going to be a manager? Who's going to be a coach?" And you'd say Tony Adams. You know, Tony Adams, because of the personality that he had, the way he was such an amazing leader on the pitch, people thought, well, he's going to be a great manager. And, you know, it hasn't really worked out for him in management terms. So, like you say, there are going to be surprises, people who you don't necessarily view as the guy who's going to do it. Nelson Vivas, for example, you know, is a manager.
I think he's
now
the assistant at Atletico Madrid, I believe.
Is that, Really? Is that where he is now?
Have I got that wrong? Nelson Vivas. It's a hell of a shout from me if it's true.
I think you could have dreamt that, did you?
Yeah, I think I dreamt that. Sorry, guys. Oh, no.
What?
2018, according to Wikipedia, assistant at Atletico Madrid.
Right.
There's a thing learning here. Vivas, trade for the very best.
Vivas served as Diego Simeone's assistant manager at Estudiantes, River Plate and San Lorenzo.
Yeah, and May 2018, Atletico Madrid appointed Nelson Vivas to join Diego Simeone's backroom staff ahead of 2018-19. I'm not sure he's still there. I mean, this is absolutely an Athletic article waiting to happen. But I...
The Athletic article is you going to track down the fan that Nelson Vivas attacked when he was in the stands that time and he's sort of shouting at him, that's that guy.
The reason I do actually know about this is because they had been doing on Athletic a 98-99 throwback. And, of course, Nelson Vivas was heavily involved in that season for failing to pick up Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank against Leeds in what remains one of the most painful Arsenal memories I have. So I think I'd done a bit of preemptive digging. So, yeah, that could be very interesting if he is indeed working there alongside Simeone.
Mm.
So, yeah, he got in a fight on the touchline, didn't he, when he was in South America?
He did. I was listening to the podcast you did with Lauren.
Yes.
And he talked about Nelson Vivas helping him. Didn't he? Didn't he say
yes,
something?
Yes, but I think he meant as a Spanish speaker.
But were they at the club at the same time?
Only just, I believe. So Lauren arrived in 2000, was it? Nelson Vivas was at Arsenal from...
Oh, 98 to 2001, but he spent the 2000 on loan to Celta Vigo. And Lauren arrived... Yeah, in 2000. So maybe there was a bit of pre-season.
I think there was a brief overlap, yeah. I can't remember who he said the other sort of Spanish speakers were who helped.
He's Silvino. He talked about
Silvino, of course.
Yeah. But Silvino, yeah. I mean, had Silvino because he was a Portuguese speaker. But where did we?
Yes.
Yeah, because he came directly from Brazil to Arsenal. But you know, maybe the similarity between Portuguese and Spanish
Portuguese
might have helped.
And Spanish speakers sometimes find some common ground. Yeah, exactly.
And I think as well, you talked about Robert Pires. They arrived at the same time, didn't they? There's that amazing picture of a young Robert Pires and a young Lauren.
And he speaks all the languages, Robert Pires, as far as I understand it.
He does. He does. Also, the way, and I said this to you offline, the way that Lauren says Martin Keown is outstanding. Outstanding. I could not figure out who he was talking about. I was going, who is Matty Q?
Matty Q.
Yeah, Matty Q. I was going, is that Matthew Upson? Was that a nickname for Matthew Upson?
I had to sort of listen a few times.
Yeah, it's great. Know. The accent is brilliant.
It's a strong accent that he's got.
Good interview as well. Really enjoyed it.
He's a great guy, isn't he? I mean, you know. And actually, I was thinking back to that team on the subject of coaches. You know, a good chunk. It's interesting because when I seem to remember a lot of people saying at a certain point in Wenger's reign, oh, it's interesting that a lot of Fergie's players go on to coach, but not many of Arsene's necessarily do, or certainly they don't within the club. But, you know, now I think when you look back at his teams, a lot of them have at least had a go, if not, you know, still doing it. I mean, from the Invincibles, we mentioned Freddie, but Sol Campbell, Patrick Vieira,
Thierry Henry,
Dennis Bergkamp's done some coaching in his time. There's probably Colo Touré is, of course, an assistant at Leicester now. There are plenty there. Nelson Vivas, of course, you know.
Yeah.
From the 2000.
I guess it would be something you might feel inspired to do if you've got a coach who's actually inspirational or who you feel, you know, has really, who understands the game and has deepened your own understanding of the game, you know?
Of course, yeah. I mean, it's something that came up in your chat with Sesk if it did it. I can't remember if it did. But if it didn't, I remember thinking this guy's going to be a coach at some point during the conversation. And, you know, when you think of the managers.
Played, I did say to him, we did talk about, you know, what happens next. And he sort of said, he's just football obsessed.
Yeah.
Obsessed with football.
And he's worked with Arsene, of course, but he's also worked with Guardiola, Conte, Mourinho.
I know.
You can boo it, but it's a hell of an eclectic mix of coaching, you know?
Sure is.
And plenty of trophies in there too. So Cesc Fabregas, you know, as retiring and then becoming Mikel Arteta's sort of assistant and eventual heir is something I'm absolutely on board.
Another thing about that Laren interview was like, I think you started with, what's your favourite Laren moment? And I think Amy went first and I was almost sure she was going to say that tackle on Ronaldo. He kicked him up in the air. Yeah. Now, it was an equally excellent moment where, you know, he I think by implication, Amy was talking about the moment where he grabbed Phil Neville by the throat. But it was that whole, the reaction to the Old Trafford thing. Yeah, that was good.
Neville by the throat. Wow. Yeah, when they build the statue of Laren, that's what it's going to be.
Oh my God, wouldn't that be amazing? I mean, if you just Google that picture, I mean, have you ever seen anybody look more terrified than Phil Neville?
No. I mean, what would be quite good is if they built that statue, but they didn't build the Phil Neville bit, because obviously who wants to see Phil Neville's face cast in bronze? And then you could go and have your picture being strangled by Laren.
Like one of those where you put your head through and you've got a cowboy outfit on or a leprechaun outfit on or whatever it might be. You could be the one who's being strangled. And you make
what an honour.
Oh my God. That'd be superb. Interactive. I mean, we're going to have to do something to get the people back to football and interested in football again. You know.
You're absolutely right. I think that would be very cool. He was great. I've got to say, we've been quite lucky as Arsenal fans. We've had some really good right backs. And when it comes to sort of pick a right back, in your sort of best 11, it's really tough, I think.
It is.
It's really tough.
It is. We did have some best 11s and best five-a-side questions and stuff like that. But, you know, I think we've done too many of those or so many of those over the last little while that, you know, we need to give them a break.
Nothing else to do.
Have you got any more or is that
I've got this one, which I just thought was quite funny. Herbie Gooner said, are corners worse now than they used to be?
in terms of the angles?
I don't know. I think it means the set piece. Am I looking back with rose-tinted specs on memories and recent highlight reels from the good old days? Just the art of the corner.
But you only ever see the good corners when you watch highlights.
That's it.
You don't see all the
long range shots.
Yeah, exactly. You only see the ones that fly into the top corner. You don't see the previous 20 that, you know, go out for throw-ins and corners and things like that. So are corners worse than they used to be? No, I think they're probably better technically than they were because you've got, you know, you're not trying to kick the ball out of a divot, for example, when you're taking a corner and everything else. Did you see, I think I retweeted it, there was a footage of a game between Arsenal and Liverpool from the 71 season. And the pitch is just astonishing.
Let me have a quick look.
It's on my timeline. Match of the day, February 1973, a typical 1970s pitch, a smash and grab by Arsenal at Anfield.
Oh my God. It's like the Somme.
It is. It's like no man's land. The pitch is literally like no man's
land. Barbed wire, mines.
Exactly. Men wandering around with limbs hanging off.
I tell you what.
Medic!
Is it just me, or do footballers not get properly muddy anymore? Muddy.
They don't get muddy. You don't get muddy. Remember when you used to play football, you come back in, you'd have like, you'd just be caked with mud.
Yeah.
All one side of you. But yeah, no, they don't get muddy anymore because they don't play on muddy pitches, even when it's lashing rain.
And I have to say, like, I miss watching games like that sometimes. Like, I love when a team's got to go and play a cup tie and on a waterlogged pitch and, like, you know, the ball holds up. I mean, not all the time, but as a novelty, it's great value. I remember watching a Chelsea game against Tromso in some old version of the Europa League. Or the Cup Winners' Cup or something like that. And it was a properly snowy pitch, you know, with like orange ball. You could barely see what was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love all that. And even in this Arsenal game that I'm watching now on your timeline from the 1973, and I'll have to confess, I don't actually know who scores this Arsenal goal where they kind of dribble from the halfway line. But the pitch is a factor in the goal. Like, the pitch enables them to sort of like knock it ahead and keep it under control by holding it up. I kind of think that's an interesting dynamic in football that, you know, it's kind of a shame in some ways that, you know, the modern football fan won't see all that.
Because
it is interesting.
It is. It does. It adds a different dynamic to it. You know, there's different dynamics to the game depending on the conditions. And like, what's the worst you get nowadays? It's just a bit cold, or it's a bit windy, or it's a bit rainy, or what have you. You know, I guess the playing field is quite level when it comes to playing surfaces these days. Everyone's got a great pitch. It would be good if somebody had a fucking crater in one end, or, you know, pitch sloped downhill, or, you know, as the season went on, the goal mouths became just like that. There was never any grass in them or whatever it might be. So,
yeah.
Anyway, maybe we'll get back there. Maybe things will fall apart to the point where pitches become terrible again and football becomes, you know, you get these moments which you don't expect simply because of the conditions that you're playing in. So who knows?
Maybe. If we can hope for anything out of this crisis, it's muddy footballers.
Muddy footballers and muddy pitches. All right. Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it there. Thank you as ever for being with us. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. And we'll do more and catch you on the next one. So until then.
Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.